On Radio 4 FM, Book of the Week, The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison tells the extraordinary story of the wife of the famous Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev. Despite earlier promises made by the Soviets, Lina and Sergei are no longer able to travel outside the USSR, and Lina finds the brutal excesses of the regime increasingly disturbing. The reader is Sian Thomas.
The distance between Sergei and Lina had grown immeasurably since their move to Moscow. Though they spent a great deal of time apart, Lina had always known her husband's schedule and general whereabouts, even when he was on extended tours. That began to change, through no fault of his or hers, at least at first. By the time he walked out, in March 1941, they had long ceased speaking to each other. She tried to keep up with him, to remain part of his life, but she was boxed in. 3 years earlier, in the spring of 1938, Lina planned to attend the premiere of Sergei's incidental music for a production of Hamlet in Leningrad. Officialdom intervened, however, and she was prohibited from taking the overnight train from Moscow, a signal that she no longer enjoyed elite status in the Soviet Union. While Hamlet was being produced, Sergei accepted a commission to write music for the film Alexander Nevsky, a piece of chest-beating propaganda about the heroic exploits of a 13th-century warrior who defeated the invading Teutonic Knights. The scenario called for protracted battle scenes, including one on the frozen surface of Lake Peipus, along with images of self-sacrifice for the nationalist cause and touches of Gogolian folk humour. It was a showcase score. In between the shooting and editing of Alexander Nevsky, Sergei left for a vacation in the Gorky Sanatorium in Kislovodsk without Lina. There, in late August 1938, he noticed that he had an admirer, an unprepossessing young woman named Mira. According to Mira, her relationship with Sergei began when she deferentially introduced herself in the sanatorium dining room. They became friends and took a trip to the Adil Su Gorge, a natural wonder. He said nothing about Adil Su or the other trysts to his wife, instead filling letters with idle chatter about the weather, his exercise regime, the comings and goings of the other guests, and his workload. Mira Abramovna Mendelssohn was just 23 when she met Sergei, then 47. The romance developed during a nightmarish period in Sergei's career, when another of his compositions was banned, his innocuous 25-minute suite of Music for Athletic Display. At the same time, he learnt that his first opera on a Soviet theme, Semyon Kotko, had to be adjusted to reflect current political realities. So, instead of fighting invading Nazis, the Ukrainian hero fought first Austrians, then, when that was deemed inappropriate, anti-Soviet Ukrainian nationalists, which rendered the sarcastic German march music in the score suddenly inapposite. Most of the adjustments were demanded after the score was finished. Sergei had composed the opera quickly because the eminent director with whom he was working, Vsevolod Meyerholt, was under pressure to salvage his reputation following a series of official attacks. For all his efforts, Sergei could not save his colleague. Meyerholt disappeared in the summer of 1939. He was savagely beaten for months, and the torture broke him. At Kislovodsk, in the summer of 1939, Sergei wrote to Lina. He didn't volunteer information about Mira, and when Lina pressed her husband to respond to the menace in the news and its potential impact on their lives, he replied in an offhand, abstract manner. He seemed less and less able to connect, to exhibit any feeling, whether about her or the world around them. That September, Sergei returned to Moscow. It soon became obvious that he intended to continue his dalliance with Mira. The pretext for seeing her was their collaboration on a new libretto, but the affair soon became public, the subject of gossip. Lena lost her dignity and her ability to control her life. As she realized the implications of the situation, she sank into depression. What devastated her was Sergei's recognition that Mira could help him in his art, his one true satisfaction, whereas Lena could not. Things worsened. The winter of 1939 to 1940 was brutal, with a record low for Moscow of minus 42.2 Celsius. Sergei was roped into the orgiastic celebrations of Stalin's 60th birthday, for which he was obliged, like his colleagues, to compose a tribute. The resulting score, a gorgeous 13-minute cantata titled Stravitsa, a toast, was composed and performed for a sum that Sergei could not refuse. On the 15th of March, 1941, nearly 3 years after he first met Mira, Sergei walked out of the apartment with a suitcase. Before that abrupt and radical move, he and Lena had exchanged final pleas, hers for reconciliation and his for immediate unconditional release. In June 1940, letters replaced conversation, despite the fact they generally remained under the same roof. Lena confessed to being on the edge of a collapse. Why had Sergei not allowed her to leave with the children, to go back to her mother and friends in France? Without him in Moscow, she would be defenceless. In response, he accused her of being manipulative, of machinations to preserve their troubled marriage. He emphasized that when Lena last emboldened herself to kiss him, he felt like an adulterer, betraying the person he truly loved, Mira. He had made his choice. On the 22nd of June, 1941, Hitler authorized his long-planned invasion of the Soviet Union. There followed the disorganized evacuations of high-level officials and other state assets, including great artists. Sergei would be away for 2 years. During the Nazi siege of Moscow, thousands of citizens mobilized to keep watch on the roofs of apartment buildings during nighttime air raids. Hundreds of small, crude firebombs rained down, igniting upon contact. Residents wearing asbestos gloves scrambled across the rooftops to hurl the firebombs to the ground. Neighbors in the courtyards then extinguished them with sand or water. Lena, Sviatoslav, and Oleg took shelter in the metro station nearest their apartment. In October 1941, with the Germans again bearing down on Moscow, the state and cooperative stores that lined Gorky Street were stripped bare. Lena was subsisting on bowls of thin soup and tablespoons of oats, grieving at the sight of her chronically malnourished sons. She spent most of her time hunting the city for food. "I sell and swap, twist and turn, but I still can't seem to escape this vicious circle," she wrote to Sergei. "I can't just give away everything I have that's sellable, that people want, for a song. And since nobody wants furniture, I don't in fact have anything valuable left." The 8-page entreaty was hand-delivered to Sergei in Alma-Ata, where he and Mira had been relocated. Had it been posted, it would not have made it past the military censors, the details being too grim, too honest. Sergei was shocked to learn the details and took immediate steps to help. He wrote letters on Lena's behalf to the Union of Soviet Composers. Despite his earnest efforts, however, Lena was rebuffed whenever she tried to access the meal hall. Neither charm, nor tenacity, nor effrontery worked for her. but shouting did. In September, she received permission for her sons to take 2 meals a day. With the end of the German attacks on Moscow in 1942, upper-level officials who had been evacuated began to trickle back into the city. Sergei returned to Moscow with Mira in October 1943. He looked dejected and miserable. The unmarried couple arranged what Lena called disgraceful accommodation in hotels. Although he continued to support his family, he declined to see them in person. The tensions increased in September 1944 when Sergei and Mira received a small apartment for themselves. He began to refer to Mira as his spouse and wrote a letter requesting a permanent divorce. It ended up in Sviatoslav's hands, and he did not have the heart to give it to his long-suffering mother. Had she received it, she would not have agreed to a divorce, since it would have left her even more vulnerable. She felt shielded enough by her marriage to fraternise with the staff at the embassies, even though such contact with foreigners was disallowed by the state as treasonous. Such socialising had its real purpose, though, to escape the Soviet Union. Sergei worried about Lena's precarious position without assisting her in her effort to leave. He had become a different person, with a different mindset. Now a true Soviet composer, he had received numerous awards and honours. Whereas he once talked about his music in terms of divine inspiration, now he referred to it in terms consistent with the regime, as expressing human potential and the triumph of the spirit. The clearest manifestation of his commitment to the communist cause was his illustrious Fifth Symphony, which received its premiere on the 13th of January, 1945. Lena and Sviatoslav attended. As Sergei prepared to give the downbeat for the first movement, the concert's presenter appeared on stage to update the audience on the progress of Soviet troops on their final march into Berlin. There was a pregnant pause as the moment of triumph was absorbed. One of the luminaries recalled that the hall was probably lit as usual, but when Prokofiev stood up, it seemed as though the light poured down on him from on high. There was something deeply significant, deeply symbolic in this, as if this moment marked a dividing line in the lives of everyone present. In the post-war period, Lena became a regular visitor at the British and American embassies. She brought herself unfavourably to the attention of the authorities by persisting in her efforts to obtain an exit permit. Riding the metro home in 1946, she became aware of a man across from her in the wood-panelled, wide-aisled carriage. He looked up at her, then down at his newspaper, and then back up again. Lena was meant to notice him, noticing her. Unnerved, she got off at her station and walked to her building and up the 3 flights of cement stairs to her apartment. She arrived home, safe, alone.
The reader was Sian Thomas, the abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
Over on BBC Radio 6 Music...
It's a basic principle of biology, of evolution, that nature doesn't produce a complicated structure for nothing. The human larynx is an extraordinarily complex piece of apparatus, and it can produce the most fantastic sounds.
This Sunday, I'm joined by Sir David Attenborough.
In the 1950s, music coming from the BBC or anywhere else wasn't a man with a guitar.
Discussing his love for music, nature, and the BBC.
Because I was very interested in folk music, I thought it'd be great to put it on television.
Jarvis Cocker's Sunday Service.
This Sunday afternoon from 4 on BBC Radio 6 Music.